Top stories this hour. Iran reacts to the U.S. accusation that it plans to supply drones to Russia, saying its cooperation with Moscow in new technology fields predates the Ukraine war. 9 European states say they will continue to work with 6 Palestinian rights organizations branded terrorists by Israel due to a lack of evidence for that claim. Rights groups slam the EU's discriminatory asylum policy, citing the appalling conditions of refugees who are not Ukrainians on the streets of Belgium. Thank you for joining us. Iran has reacted to a U.S. claim that it is planning to supply hundreds of drones to Russia. The Foreign Ministry spokesman says there is no recent development in technological cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Nasser Kanani said Iran's cooperation with Russia in the field of some new technologies predates the war in Ukraine. He added that his country's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced before. The spokesman noted that Washington's claim comes from the U.S. and Europe have for years turned aggressive countries, including in the West Asia region, into a storehouse of their lethal weapons. On Monday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that Tehran is preparing to send several hundreds of drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has concluded an official visit to Italy. It's been 48 hours of an intense activity which included talks with top Italian and Vatican diplomats and meetings with entrepreneurs, geopolitical analysts and Iranian expats. Max Civili has more from Rome.
On Tuesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian wrapped up a two-day visit to Italy, which is expected to boost Tehran's relations with Rome and the Catholic Church. Amir Abdollahian's visit kicked off on Monday at Italy's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Iran's top diplomat held talks with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio in pursuit of political, economic and commercial cooperation. The two discussed a number of issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, Yemen and Ukraine, and the resumption of talks on the revival of the 2015 deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the end of the meeting, Iran's top diplomat stated that there is a promised bright future for the cooperation between Tehran and Rome in the field of energy.
At a political level, it remains to be seen if the Italian government's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge. Much will depend on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. President Biden's Middle East trip.
On Tuesday, the Iranian minister, after participating at a meeting with geopolitical analysts and policymakers at the think tank Institute of International Affairs, held talks with Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin at the Vatican. How interfaith dialogue plays a key role in alleviating violence and extremism was among the issues touched upon during the meeting. In April, Iran's foreign minister held a phone talk with his counterpart from the Vatican. The top Iranian diplomat talked about painful and inhuman disasters unfolding the world today, which he blamed on a lack of morality and ethics in international relations.
The meeting between the Iranian minister and Cardinal Parolin is an important event, a confirmation of long-standing relations and consolidated friendship between Iran and the Holy See, a meeting that is even more important under the current tensions afflicting the world.
Cultural and economic ties between Tehran and Rome have experienced ups and downs over time, yet Italy has ranked at the top in Europe in terms of volume of trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
9 EU states have rejected Israel's designation of 6 Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist associations. The countries say they will continue to work with the Palestinians. In a joint statement, the foreign ministries of Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain and Sweden said Israel did not provide credible evidence for its claim. The statement said as long as such evidence is absent, they will continue strong support for the civil society in the occupied Palestinian territories. Earlier in April, UN human rights experts said the Israeli claims undermined their work as several funders had delayed their contributions while the accusations were being investigated. The rights experts had also called on the international community to continue their support. Activists from Palestine Action, a direct action network demanding an end to British complicity with Israeli apartheid, have stormed an arms manufacturing company in Glasgow, Scotland. Activists have shuttered two of the company's sites only in the past few months. Saeed Pourreza reports from London.
Protesters from Palestine Action Scotland scaling the roof of one of the world's largest arms companies in Glasgow, demanding that the facility be shut down. They're soon arrested by Scottish police, but they've done the damage they intended.
They've obviously realised that asking nicely has not worked. The government hasn't made any lasting change, and they have taken measures into their own hands where the government has chosen not to.
The activists, who were taken in court and released later, accused the Paris-headquartered multinational TALS group of making an array of lethal weapons that help enforce the Israeli apartheid against Palestinians. The Watchkeeper drone is one of the group's deadly products, developed in collaboration with a notorious Israeli weapons company that's been the target of these activists for years now.
In 2019, TALS made 8.3 billion euros in profit, and that wasn't just off the suffering and oppression of Palestinians. It was from the oppression of refugees worldwide. Their business is oppression, their business is genocide, and they're willing to sacrifice millions upon millions of lives for profit.
The building behind me used to house the headquarters of Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. Earlier this year, and after 2 years of relentless direct action, Palestine Action say, they forced the company to close down and leave, getting one step closer to ending Israel's arms trade in Britain.
That came only 5 months after the company was forced to close up shop in the northwestern city of Oldham, Greater Manchester. Elbit Systems still has 8 more sites in the UK. Palestine Action say they will continue to throw a spanner in the works of Elbit and companies that collaborate with it until they're all closed and until Palestine is free. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Dozens of refugees live in appalling conditions on the streets of Belgium, but none of them are from Ukraine. Rights groups say the EU's asylum policy is discriminatory. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It's 7 a.m. on Tuesday, the 12th of July, 2022, and outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city centre. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the centre to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine.
On the face of it, this might look like a Belgium problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination?
That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence, and with our support, they need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nominations in the race to replace British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have closed, with 8 Conservative lawmakers securing enough support to make the first ballot. Candidates needed backing from at least 20 fellow legislators to be on the ballot for the runoff votes, which will start on Wednesday. Former Health Secretary Sajid Javid, whose resignation last week helped bring Johnson down, was a surprise casualty, failing to make the cut. 2 other candidates, Transport Secretary Grant Shapps and lawmaker Rahman Chisti, also pulled out after struggling to gather support. The candidates are jostling to replace Johnson, who quit as the Conservative leader last week amid a party revolt triggered by months of ethics scandals. He will remain in office as a caretaker prime minister until his replacement as party chief is chosen. The winner of the contest will automatically become prime minister without the need for a national election. It's the 27th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, which saw thousands of Bosnian Muslims slaughtered in cold blood by Bosnian Serbs in 1995 following the breakup of Yugoslavia. The genocide against Muslims was so traumatic that victims remain unfound even to this day. Robert Carter reports on the latest burials and the remaining fears of a repeat.
Another year and more bodies of murdered Bosnian Muslims have been returned to their families as part of commemorations held to mark the 27th anniversary of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. Close to three decades after being brutally murdered, the remains of 47 men and three teenage boys were laid to rest at Srebrenica's memorial cemetery.
We found the incomplete bodies 5 years ago. We waited to find more, but it didn't happen. So we decided to bury what we have. Also, I have one more brother who was never found, and I have another brother that we buried before.
It was the worst atrocity on European soil since Nazi Germany, as 8,000 Bosnian Muslim civilians were dragged off and killed by Bosnian Serb forces before being dumped into mass graves. The Srebrenica killings were the bloody peak of Bosnia's war, which came after the breakup of Yugoslavia. The conflict has become characterized by ethnic cleansing and genocide. Many Western countries, along with the United Nations, have been condemned for failing to act in the face of overwhelming evidence war crimes were being committed.
What Muslims need to realise is the years of propaganda by politicians made it all possible. The 8,000 plus dead, the concentration camps, the use of rape of Muslim women as a deliberate weapon of war so then they would breed the next generation of Serbs. All of these horrors happened because politicians wanted to divide so then they could rule. And even now, nearly 30 years later, guilty Serbian war criminals like Milosevic and Karadzic are seen as heroes and their crimes denied.
On Monday, Holland's defence minister publicly apologised for the massacre, admitting the international community failed to offer adequate protection.
But critics claim it's too little, far too late. What's more alarming is that Islamophobia remains a very persistent problem right across Europe. Following the fall of Nazi Germany, anti-Semitism is taken incredibly seriously by European authorities. But can the same be said regarding anti-Muslim hate? Robert Carter, London.
Muslim pilgrims have wrapped up the annual Hajj pilgrimage and are now getting prepared to leave the holy city of Mecca. Mahdi Abbasian has a report.
After spending a night in Muzdalifa, a town between Mina and Arafat, and collecting 49 pebbles for the next day's stoning of the devil ritual, Muslims marched in a great procession to the city of tents, Mina. The stoning of the devil ritual includes stoning three pillars which symbolize the devil and the sins. On Eid al-Adha, pilgrims headed to Jamarat Bridge, where they threw seven pebbles at one of the three pillars that symbolized the devil. Then they returned to Mina, offering sacrifices. The animal is butchered and its meat is packed and shipped to other countries or is fed to the poor. After that, men shaved their heads. This act symbolizes one's detachment from physical appearances and complete subjection to God.
It is a symbol of killing all negative things inside you. It teaches us to clean our hearts from every kind of darkness. Therefore, that is why we throw the stones.
On the 11th and 12th days of Hajj, pilgrims must complete the stoning of the devil by throwing seven pebbles at each pillar in Jamarat.
1 month ahead of the anniversary of the United States' chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, the White House has launched discussions on how to approach the occasion to avoid missteps that could add to President Joe Biden's political woes. This as the anniversary reminds Afghans of moments of betrayal and disaster. Rahmatullah Baghwan reports from Kabul.
Chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 is considered as one of President Biden's biggest failures. The NBC News revealed that the White House and U.S. agencies have started discussions on how to handle the anniversary of withdrawal to prevent further political damage to the president. Afghan experts believe that by reversing the truth, the Biden administration will try to sweep their failures under the carpet and turn a blind eye on the miseries of Afghans whose lives were spoiled by messy withdrawal.
The U.S. and Western propaganda have always had the skill of broadcasting historical events in a way they want. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has not been an exception to this rule. It's clear that the U.S. will whitewash its withdrawal mission in its anniversary to keep their global prestige. While we and the world witnessed the U.S. mess in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as a result of their failure, a political system collapsed, NATO-Afghanistan agreement was broken, and dozens of Afghans were devastated. Most importantly, the U.S. lost its reputation as NATO gendarme.
Shahir, who is in hiding, was left behind by the U.S. He and his family members were asked to come to the airport, but weren't airlifted. He is angry with the U.S., and is still shocked from the sorrowful, frustrating, and insulting evacuation process. He says he feels betrayed by the U.S.
When I made it to the gate of the airport along with my family members, the NATO forces were firing bullets and tear gas everywhere. Inside Kabul airport, we witnessed four Afghans shot dead and three others injured by the U.S. forces. People were panicked, running everywhere. While I was showing my documents, NATO forces hit me with sticks and it started bleeding. Then I gave up as I felt insulted and betrayed by the U.S.
The U.S. 20-year devastating war on Afghanistan ended with a disastrous withdrawal. Several Afghans fell from American aircrafts. Some were shot dead and wounded. Many children were lost. Moreover, a U.S. airstrike hit a house in the airport neighborhoods, killing 10 family members, including women and children. The chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan in 2021 reminds Afghans of those ugly and tragic days. People here blame the ill-prepared U.S. for spoiling the lives of thousands of Afghan people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that's a wrap on the world news. Thanks for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, a National Union of Students survey has found a third of all university students are left with £50 a month to live on after paying for rent and bills. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Sophie Zeldin O'Neill. The piece is titled One in Ten Students Turn to Food Banks in Cost of Learning Crisis. In Britain, more than one in ten students are using food banks because they cannot make ends meet during the cost of living crisis, according to a new survey by the National Union of Students, the NUS. The poll of more than 3,500 university students found that 11% of students are using food banks, up from 5% in January, while 96% are cutting back as a result of soaring prices and bills. One in five say they're unable to buy toiletries, and one in ten cannot purchase sanitary products when required. It was reported last month that there has been a 3,000% increase in the number of graduates who owe more than £100,000 in student loan debts. In 2016, the Sutton Trust charity found that British university graduates have the highest debt in the English-speaking world, and the average loan balance has risen since then. The National Union of Students survey found that a third of all university students are living on less than £50 a month after paying their rent and bills, with many reporting that their maintenance funds are not enough to pay for a weekly shop, allow them to travel to university, or cover their energy bills. The poll also revealed a cost of learning crisis, as three-quarters of university students said they would be unable to pay for course materials without more support. 4 in 10, or 42%, say they're unable to make it on the university campus. 4 in 10, or 42%, say they're unable to make it on to university campus or are being forced to travel less, and 41% are neglecting their health so they can save money by missing out on extras such as dental appointments. 9 in 10, or 92%, say the crisis is affecting their mental health, with 31% of university students saying rising costs are having a major impact. Only a fifth of university students say they have received any government support, and only 8% said they felt ministers are doing enough to support them. More than 8 in 10, or 83%, have sought financial support through other means, such as using credit cards, buy now and pay later credit schemes, such as Klarna, or taking out bank loans. More than half, or 53%, of university students say they have turned to family and friends for support, while 40% have reached out to them for loans. According to the new National Union of Students survey, a third of students say the rising cost of living has also had an impact on their families. Students with caring responsibilities and disabilities, those who are estranged from their families, and people from poorer backgrounds have all been affected more by the cost of living crisis. A National Union of Students spokesperson said, "Huge increases in the price of bills, price of food and living costs, coupled with soaring rent, has students on the brink. We're seeing stress and anxiety piling on them from bouncing debt between different cards to stay afloat." Despite all of this, students are being completely ignored by the government. These findings are bleak. We're knee-deep in a cost of learning crisis that would affect the poorest students the hardest. The National Union of Students has called on the government to put in place a tailored cost of living support package for university students, as well as requesting that student maintenance provisions and the apprentice minimum wage be brought into line with the living wage. Meanwhile, union leaders have warned newly appointed cabinet ministers that many teachers and nurses will quit their professions in the coming weeks if public sector pay deals are further delayed by chaos at the top of the government. The decision last Thursday by Prime Minister Boris Johnson to step down as Prime Minister and a series of changes to his cabinet have left public sector workers increasingly fearful that long overdue pay rises will be pushed back to the autumn.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us listen to a beautiful aphorism from the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible heir, Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him. He who obeys God will not care for the dissatisfaction of the people.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, preserving respect. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of preserving respect. When we look at the Islamic text, we see that Islam has ordered us to respect each other. And in order to respect each other, the first step is to preserve the respect of the others, to respect the others. And if they have any kind of ugliness or if they have any kind of shortcomings, then we need to cover all these things, because the person who is the brother in Iman, he is my believing brother, he's a Muslim, I must respect him and make him respectful. When we look at the Allah's treatment with us, we see that Allah is hiding everything, all our faults, all our uglinesses, all our shortcomings, all the evils that we perform. If we are doing it when we are alone, then Allah is also hiding this from others. Maybe I have a habit which I do not like others to know. This is not me who is hiding. It is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who is hiding all my shortcomings. Therefore, it is necessary, according to the Islamic teachings, that when you know about something in relation to your brother in Iman, your religious brother or the Muslim brother, the first thing you need to do is to preserve it, to preserve his honor, to preserve his respect in the eyes of others, to do not talk about this, to do not make it apparent to the others. And this is what we need to learn. And this brings more respect in the society, in the community, and people will start respecting each other in a better way, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of preserving respect of a mu'min in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that it is necessary to preserve the respect and honor of a Muslim brother or a mu'min brother. And this is what we learn from the Islamic teachings. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said that whoever says something in order to disrespect or bring a disrespect in relation to a mu'min brother, for example, he has a respect in a specific community or society, he has that respect. And if you do say something in order to bring the disrespect in relation to him, then obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will take this person out of his wilayah. The person who is being the cause of disrespecting others, Allah will take him away from his wilayah, from his guardianship. And he put him under the guardians of the guardianship of the shaitan or the evil or the Satan. Whereas in the Quran, Allah says, Allahu waliyul ladhina amanu yukhrijuhum min adh-dhulumati ila an-nur. Allah takes the mu'mineen, the believers, out of the darknesses and he takes them towards the light. But if someone tries to disrespect another mu'min, the one whose faults, whose shortcomings, whose ugliness is been hidden by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if someone tries to do that purposefully, Allah takes this person who has made this cause, who become the cause of disrespect of a mu'min brother from the nur, and he throws them towards the darknesses. Therefore, we need to be careful, insha'Allah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Elephants are the largest living animals on earth that in many cultures are associated with good luck, wisdom and fertility. But their overpopulation has become a matter of concern in the southeastern African nation of Malawi.
We want to reduce the population of elephants in this park, in Liwonde National Park, because currently we have 600 plus elephants in this park. We would be comfortable, ecologically speaking, that is, to have 300 elephants in this park.
Officials say they will relocate 250 elephants from a national park in a southern town to another park by the end of July. They say the plan is part of a national conservation initiative to maintain healthy habitats in the country's national parks. Establishing viable elephant populations and ensuring the prosperity of local communities around the parks are said to be the other aspects. Residents say the elephants often stray into their gardens and damage their crops. Authorities had relocated some 300 elephants from the same town in 2019.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationships between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, 8 cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuanxuan and Jinjin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuanxuan and Xinxin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat-breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the grey green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground. There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day since the menu largely includes local flavors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A young British artist has found an incredible way to create art using not pen or paper, but typewriter. symbols and letters are turned into complex drawings by this 25-year-old's adept fingers, gaining him attention online. London-based James Cook, who studied architecture, used to draw portraits. But that all changed when he discovered his now signature tool, the typewriter, in 2014. He says the idea came to his mind when he came across Paul Smith, an artist from the 1920s, who produced similar work. Initially, Cook thought it impossible, but he gave it a try. Now, after 8 years, he can draw complex images from Hollywood star Tom Hanks to the London Eye or the Millennium Bell. But while his works appear flawless to viewers, Cook says it never gets any easier and that it's always a challenge for him.
There's something really satisfying about kind of using this sort of limited palette of... You basically have about 44 keys on a typewriter on average. So you've got to kind of puzzle piece those letters, numbers, punctuation marks together to make a drawing.
Recently, online interest has encouraged Cook to pursue his passion. People donate their typewriters to Cook, who gives these machines a second life. He now has a collection of more than 40 typewriters dating from the early 20s.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to two more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil. In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit.
You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Ortman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Some commentators think US Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called center. We now present you an article written by Robert Reich, a former US Secretary of Labor and a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Republican Party is Terrible, so why may Democrats lose to them this year?" Much of today's Republican Party is treacherous and treasonous. So why are Democrats facing midterm elections that, according to most political observers, they're likely to lose? Having been a loyal Democrat for some 70 years, including a stint as a cabinet secretary, it pains me to say this. The Democratic Party has lost its way. Some commentators think Democrats have moved too far to the left, too far from the so-called center. But this is utter rubbish. Where's the center between democracy and authoritarianism? And why would Democrats want to be there? Others think President Biden hasn't been sufficiently angry or outraged. But what good would that do? After 4 years of Donald Trump, why would anyone want more anger and outrage? The real failure of the Democratic Party is its loss of the American working class. as Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg concluded after the 2016 presidential election. Democrats don't have a white working class problem. They have a working class problem, which progressives have been reluctant to address honestly or boldly. The fact is that Democrats have lost support with all working class voters across the electorate. The working class used to be bedrock of the Democratic Party, but what happened? During the first 2 years of the Clinton, Obama and Biden administrations, when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, they purportedly scored some victories for working families. For example, the Affordable Care Act, an expanded earned income tax credit, and the Family and Medical Leave Act. But they also allowed the middle class to hollow out and the working class to sink. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton passed free trade agreements without providing millions of blue-collar workers who consequently lost their jobs a means of getting new ones that paid at least as well. His North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, and plan for China to join the World Trade Organization undermined the wages and economic security of manufacturing workers across America, hollowing out vast swathes of the Rust Belt. Bill Clinton also deregulated Wall Street. This led to the financial crisis of 2008, in which Barack Obama bailed out the biggest banks and bankers, but did nothing for homeowners, many of whom owed more on their homes than their homes were worth. Barack Obama didn't demand as a condition for the bailout that banks refrain from foreclosing on underwater homeowners. Nor did Obama demand an overhaul of the banking system. Instead, he allowed Wall Street to water down attempts at re-regulation. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama stood by as corporations hammered trade unions. They failed to reform labor laws to allow workers to form unions with a simple up or down majority vote, or even to impose meaningful penalties on companies that violated labor protections. Joe Biden has supported labor law reform but hasn't fought for it, leaving the Protecting the Right to Organize Act to die inside his ill-fated Build Back Better Act. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama allowed antitrust enforcement to ossify, enabling large corporations to grow far larger and major industries to become more concentrated. Joe Biden claims he is trying to revive antitrust enforcement, but hasn't made it a centerpiece of his administration. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama depended on big money from corporations and the wealthy. Both turned their backs on campaign finance reform. Barack Obama was the first presidential nominee since Richard Nixon to reject public financing in his primary and general election campaigns. And he never followed up on his re-election promise to pursue a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United versus FEC, the 2010 Supreme Court opinion opening the floodgates to big money in American politics. Joe Biden has tried to supposedly regain the trust of the working-class Americans, but Democratic lawmakers, most obviously and conspicuously Senators Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema, have blocked measures that would have lowered the cost of childcare, the cost of elder care, prescription drugs, health care and education. They've blocked a higher minimum wage and paid family leave. Yet neither Senator Joe Manchin, nor Senator Kirsten Sinema, nor any other Democrat who has failed to support Biden's agenda has suffered any consequences. Why hasn't Biden done more to rally the working class and build a coalition to grab back power from the emerging oligarchy? Presumably for the same reasons that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama didn't. The Democratic Party continues to prioritize the votes of suburban swing voters who supposedly determine electoral outcomes. And it still depends on money from big corporations and the wealthy. The most powerful force in American politics today is anti-establishment fury at a rigged system. There is no longer a left or a right. There is no longer a moderate center in American politics. And the real choice is either Republican authoritarian populism or Democratic progressive populism. Democrats cannot defeat authoritarian populism without an agenda of radical democratic reform, a pro-democracy anti-establishment movement. Democrats must stand squarely on the side of working people against oligarchy. They must form a united coalition of people of all races, of all genders and classes to unrig the system. Trumpism is not the cause of our divided nation. It is the symptom of a rigged system that was already dividing us.
Palestine Declassified.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm Chris Williamson, and I'm the host for today's show. We're looking at an innovative new anti-Zionist initiative today that's recently been launched in Boston. It's known as the Mapping Project, and it attempts to map the intersections of the Zionist movement and US imperialism. It focuses on the police, weapons companies, and other oppressive institutions. I'll be speaking to experts on this to find out more after this report from Bianca Rahimi to provide more background on the Mapping Project and how it's been subjected to predictable assaults from the Zionist movement.
The Mapping Project is a collective project of the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS group in Boston, which aims to map the intersection of the Zionist movement and elements of the US imperial power and action. They say their goal in producing collective mapping was to reveal local entities and networks that enact devastation, so we can dismantle them. Every entity, they state, has an address. Every network can be disrupted. Unsurprisingly, the project was immediately threatened by Zionist groups being denounced by the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, which quite rightly features in the maps for its role in radicalizing US police departments with Islamophobic Zionist counter-terror tactics. The ADL has also operated since before the creation of Israel to target Arab Americans and accuse them of anti-Semitism. As the Mapping Project correctly states, the ADL has worked hand in glove with the FBI ever since and currently operates as a lobby group pursuing manufactured anti-Semitism claims as well as fulfilling its function as a spy agency on behalf of Mossad. The Mapping Project was also denounced by the Jerusalem Post. Failing to see the irony, the Post cited Zionist groups criticizing the project, including the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Lior Hayat and the Zionist regime asset Stand With Us. Stand With Us claimed that the project is mapping out and targeting synagogues, Jewish schools and other Jewish institutions, and slanderously claiming these organizations are actually participating in the colonization of Palestine. But colonization is exactly what they are supporting. Shockingly, however, the BDS movement said it did not endorse the project, and Ariel Gold, the alleged Palestine rights advocate, stated that it literally targets Jewish teen and youth organizations.